Welcome back to the channel. I want to talk about a topic that's often difficult to talk about, and that's when patient advocacy organizations take substantial or perhaps even predominant funding from the pharmaceutical industry and then go out there and claim to represent the voice of patients. So we're going to get into this. The first thing we have to acknowledge is patients are the most important voice at the table of all of biomedicine. We want to know how patients feel, what they think about their condition, about drugs, about development, and their voice is the single most important voice we can consider, more than the policymakers, more than the regulators, more than the pharmaceutical industry. And I do want to hear from patients. I want to hear from the full range of patients who have a wide range of opinions, who have a wide range of experiences, and I want to know what they think and what advocacy they want. Unfortunately, the way we've codified this in the modern system of having patient advocacy organizations and their funding sources compromises, I think, the fundamental mission of hearing from patients. So let's go through that. Number one, we did a study maybe about a decade ago in the Mayo Clinic proceedings called the Industry Funding of Cancer Patient Advocacy Organizations. And we looked at 68 patient advocacy organizations that were recommended by a major body, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. We found 75% of them were funded by the pharmaceutical industry with a median number of sponsors of 7 pharmaceutical firms. The moment a patient advocacy organization starts to be heavily funded by pharma, the moment you start to worry that they're actually astroturf, they're actually subverted, they're actually working for the interests of pharma, even though they may not fully recognize that. How might that manifest? If the patient advocacy organization, for instance, is very vocal about lowering the regulatory standards of approval, of having a flood of unproven new options, and simultaneously, if they're very quiet about the high and unsustainable price of cancer drugs, about the out-of-pocket co-payments that cripple many families, that to me is a marker that perhaps they're being influenced by the payment. There are other ways that it can be problematic, which we're going to get into. But there's one more point I want to make about patient advocacy groups right off the bat. Out of all the patients I've taken care of in my career in medicine, which is now about 10 years as an attending physician, and then another 10 years of training before that, have included medical school. In all these years of practicing medicine, I've seen a range of patients, patients who've done really well, patients who've done poorly. I've seen patients of high socioeconomic status and patients of low socioeconomic status. The patient advocacy organizations are not comprised of the average patient. They're not comprised of a range of patients. They're comprised disproportionately of patients who are doing well. Unfortunately, patients who pass away very quickly, who suffer severe drug-induced toxicities like drug-induced Parkinsonism, which is a side effect of CAR-T therapy and myeloma, those patients don't or can't participate in these meetings. Patients of low socioeconomic status often don't participate in the advocacy organizations. So the advocacy groups, the people who speak at drug advisory meetings, they're already a select slice of all the patients out there, the people who are doing well, who are not suffering terrible, crippling toxicity that keeps them at home. They're people who are alive. A few years ago, I proposed that one solution to hearing from just the patients who do well on a drug and actually hearing from the average patient who takes a drug would be to build in video diaries into clinical trials. If you're running a clinical trial of a new drug product, give everyone a GoPro, give everyone a camera, give everyone an iPhone app, and ask them to take a video of themselves once a week to talk about their experience. What are the pros of taking the drug, and what are the side effects they're experiencing? Because all the people who have had crippling side effects, who may have died before the advisory meeting, they're not there to tell their story. You're only hearing from the one or two people who are doing really well, and often they believe they're doing well because of the drug. That might not even be the reason they're doing well. They might be doing well just because they have indolent or slow-growing biology. So I think fundamentally we have a problem that the patient groups are typically only the tip of the iceberg, the people who have done disproportionately well with their disease, and often, in my opinion, the people who are more affluent and more connected and more willing to participate in these groups. A lot of people, myself included, if I were to be a patient, I don't think I would be very vocal and active in a patient advocacy group because there are other things in my life I'd want to do with my time. And I think I see that a lot when I work at the Veterans Administration, when I work at the county hospital. I see people who have a lot going on in their life and they may not have the bandwidth to take on an advocacy group. Now let's talk about the funding. I think patient groups enter into this very perverse relationship when they start to realize there's not a lot of funding for patient groups. And if we really wanted to empower patients, we would ask that the NIH take a huge chunk of their budget and give grants out, huge grants out, to create impartial patient groups that actually try to represent people of all races, all socioeconomic status, all ethnicities, of all points of view, to get the diversity of different points of view in the advocacy groups. But we don't have that. We have a system where it's very difficult for patient groups to get funding. And naturally, they go to the only person, the big entity, that's willing to fund them and give them large, unrestricted grants. And that's pharma, the pharmaceutical firms. But pharma never gives you money without thinking about their return on investment. They're not in the charity business. They're in the ROI business. So every time they pay a doctor for an advertisement board, an ad board, advisory board, advisory board, they're doing that because that has a positive ROI, return on investment, by paying that doctor some pittance and buttering them up and making them think that their opinion is valuable to the company, that they buy allegiance from that doctor. When they fund the patient advocacy groups, they're funding the groups and often participating in the dialogue. They're showing that they're not the enemy of the patient groups, even though they may be the ones charging the usury fees for their products, the fees that keep them huge revenue and huge profit margins, the fees that prevent the drug from being given out globally to patients. Even though that the company is fundamentally a culprit in this system, they may be seen as the ally of the patient group, and the patient group may be less likely to criticize them. The same is true for drug approval. Make no mistake about it. When a drug company comes forward, when all the drug companies come forward and they say, we want a new lower permissive regulatory endpoint for approval, they're doing it because it has a positive return on investment. Last week, many of you know, I testified in front of the US FDA and I talked about minimal residual disease negativity as an accelerated approval endpoint for multiple myeloma. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more in this video because I think it allows us to see some of these problematic issues. Of course, you may have watched my last video where I gave 5 reasons why the FDA should not allow MRD negativity as an accelerated approval endpoint for newly diagnosed myeloma. Now, make no mistake about it, myeloma is a devastating and life-threatening disease, and there is an unmet need for people who've progressed through all the available options. They don't have great options, and drugs should be made available to those patients expeditiously. But that's not what this meeting was about. It was about taking those drugs and moving them all the way to the front line to potentially 30,000 Americans diagnosed with newly diagnosed myeloma who already have 17 different treatment options and 14 different FDA-approved drugs, and inserting the new drug on top of or in lieu of these established regimens. And they're not doing that with proof that it makes you live longer or live better. They're only doing that with proof that there are fewer plasma cells, the cancer cells in your bone marrow. But the problem with that is not all of the drugs that cause fewer plasma cells in your bone marrow are actually better for you in the long run. Some have serious toxicities like drug-induced Parkinsonism. Some have serious toxicities like recurrent infections. And sometimes fewer plasma cells might not mean living longer. The FDA's own analysis, done in concert with a couple of private groups, shows that drugs that increase MRD negativity do not, in fact, lead to longer lives. The correlation coefficients are very poor. MRD negativity is not a surrogate for longevity. It's prognostic, of course, at the individual level, and that's very different because many things can be prognostic at an individual level, but you can't make regulatory decisions based on that. Now, I think at the FDA meeting, every single one of the speakers was supportive of MRD negativity as a basis of approval, and none of them really dealt with the points I made in my last video, that this would mean moving drugs to the front line to tens of thousands of people with inadequate safety testing. They said, well, of course the FDA doesn't approve unsafe drugs. That's a fallacy. The fallacy is the FDA uses phase 1 clinical trials to come up with a very preliminary safety signal. Phase 1 clinical trials do not test the full safety profile of drugs. They test the MTD, the maximum tolerated dose of a drug. They may find huge safety signals, but they don't find all of the safety concerns. For instance, CAR T therapy causes Parkinson's disease in people. That was not known for 7 years. It was happening all the time, but it wasn't known for 7 years after the products were infused because it takes time to make these connections. People thought, oh, old person had myeloma, got the product, he has Parkinson's. Well, Parkinson's happens to older people, right? Coincidence, but it wasn't coincidence. It was caused by the product. The same is true for the bispecific antibodies. It takes 18 or 24 months of therapy before the immune system is so depressed that people start to have recurrent infections. So the more you move those drugs up earlier to more people, and the faster you do that, there are going to be safety signals you're missing. That might be fine in people who are going to die very quickly anyway, and they're willing to take the gamble. But when you're talking about people with a life expectancy of 15 years, when you're talking about people with decades in front of them, getting Parkinson's and living with Parkinson's disease for 15 years when there were other drugs available that didn't have that side effect and you would have lived just as long, that's an untenable bargain. So the FDA was making a mistake by rushing these drugs to market. But of course, every pharmaceutical firm wants them to do that. They're going to make a boatload of money. Already, the cost to treat a single individual patient with newly diagnosed myeloma is $600,000 per year of therapy, if you get something like Dara VRD, for instance, with all the accoutrements on the side. If you start to add in teclistamab, talquetamab, GPRC5D CAR T therapy, the cost will pile up. I mean, we're facing a situation where we'll be spending $1 million or more per myeloma patient per year, and that would be fine if they were living longer and living better as a result, but we would not know that. And the current FDA system will never know that because overall survival is not considered an endpoint that they care about. In other words, they care that they're going to exclude a deterioration in survival, but they don't care to confirm a benefit of survival. That's the crux of the issue. Okay, so a few thoughts here. The patient advocates who spoke at the meeting, in many cases, they were impassioned and they talked about the benefits of having MRD negativity as an endpoint. Some of the things they said were incorrect. Let's run through those. Number one, they said that, you know, if you don't have MRD negativity as an endpoint, you neglect the 40% of myeloma patients who will be dead in 5 years. That statistic comes from the National Cancer Institute SEER data set, where 40% of myeloma patients are dead in 5 years. At the same time, I said in the beginning of this video that the reason they want MRD negativity as the regulatory endpoint is they say it takes too long to show benefits in PFS or OS. Those take too long. And in fact, in the Perseus study of Dara VRD, it had a 90% survival at 4 years. Wait, how do we square these two figures? You're saying 40% of people are dead in 5 years, but 10% of people were dead at 4 years in Perseus. How do we square these two figures? Well, they come from different data sets. Perseus are the patients who participate in clinical trials, whereas the 40% dead at 5 years, that's the average American with myeloma. When the companies want you to use, when the companies want to argue that it takes too long to collect a survival endpoint, they use the clinical trial population, these healthy, fit, well-connected, often wealthy patients in clinical trials. They use that population. They say, oh, 90% are alive at 4 years. It's going to take decades to find a survival benefit. One, that's wrong because you don't have to wait for the median to find the survival benefit. Two, it's taking so long because you're not enrolling the average person with myeloma. If you were to enroll the average person with myeloma, like in the National Cancer SEER data set, there would be 40% dead in 5 years. It would be very easy and tractable to show survival benefit in just a couple years with a very large randomized trial if you actually took average Americans. But you're not. You have all these exclusion criteria that exclude people who are sick, who may have renal dysfunction or hepatic dysfunction, and you're cherry-picking patients. And then you're saying, well, in our cherry-picked patient population, it takes us a long time to find survival benefit. We need a shortcut. Here's a shortcut. How about you test your drugs in the average American? That's a shortcut. But that's not what the advocacy groups are saying. If they were really advocates for average Americans, they would say that. They're not. They're saying we need the shortcut. We need the shortcut. They're using the 40% statistic when it suits them, but they're not using the 10% statistic, and they're using the 10% statistic when it suits them, but they're not being consistent in that argument. The next point I want to make, MRD negativity is about payment. It's not about approval. Let me put it to you this way. There's not a single drug that I'm aware of that's being tested in the front line of myeloma that isn't already approved in a latter line. CAR T is approved in the latter line, teclistamab, talquetamab, all these drugs are approved in the latter line. And if you're approved in any line of therapy in the United States, a doctor can give you the drug in any line of therapy. There is no restriction on off-label prescribing. You're allowed to prescribe off-label. And anybody with money, with a doctor who's willing to give a drug, can pay for that drug. So right now, if the FDA gives you MRD negativity approval or not, you can get a CAR T with your Dara VRD if you want. If you pay for it out of your own pocket, somebody will do it. But the reason you can't get it practically is that your insurance company won't pay for it because they're going to say, we want data for that. The meeting was framed as if MRD negativity will grant access to these products for patients, but they already have access. They can already get it. The meeting is really about MRD negativity as an endpoint to compel the insurer to pay. It's about the payment, compelling CMS to pay and the insurer to pay. To me, that's a challenge when you're asking society to pay for products that we don't even know help you live longer, live better. It's just a guess, and it's a weak guess at that because the correlation coefficients are poor. You're taxing the person who's a plumber, the person who's working the night shift, the person who's a waitress. You're taxing them to pay for these drug products that may or may not make people live longer. The next point I want to make, the money is not being transferred from the plumber to the patient. Oh, no, no, no. the money is transferred from the plumber to the shareholders of the company, and the company shareholders are taking a tiny fraction of that money and paying for the development of the product. The products often cost a pittance compared to the manufacturing price. The product costs many times more than the manufacturing price, and many times more than the R&D outlay. We've shown that in some elegant papers over the years. So it's a financial transfer of money from all the people being taxed to all the people who own stock in the companies, and the patient's only deriving some small sliver of that money, the cost of the product plus R&D, and may not be deriving any of the benefit. In some senses, it's a financial product with the rare adverse event of improved health outcomes. The advocacy associations don't see it that way. They think that the money's going to them. It's not. It's a misnomer. It's going to the shareholders, and the cost to make the CAR-T product is probably $20,000. They're charging $470,000 for the product. I get those numbers from Carl June's interview in the New York Times, $20,000, and the $473,000 is the price of the product. Okay. To my knowledge, accelerated approval in myeloma based on MRD is the only time that accelerated approval is being given in the front line. We already give accelerated approval in the latter line of therapy in myeloma and in lung cancer and in pancreas cancer and in breast cancer. We give approvals based on response in all these cancers, but never for people with newly diagnosed disease. We want evidence that by giving the drugs sooner and earlier, they have a benefit over getting the drug on the back end. But myeloma is the only one where we're going to give accelerated approval in the front line. That's not true in lung cancer, where the survival is worse. It's not true in follicular lymphoma, where the survival is better. There's a certain carve-out for myeloma. We have the first time I'm aware of MRD negativity in the front line, perhaps with the exception of PathCR, but that's not exactly the same situation because that's adjuvant, not advanced or metastatic. Okay. The advocacy associations don't see that. They don't see that they're making a real interesting carve-out for one disease. They don't see that this is really about reimbursement. It's not about access because these drugs are already available. Cure. Many people there said that this is the only path to cure. That's also incorrect. If MRD negativity meant cure, and if this were a path to cure, then the FDA's correlation coefficients would be very strong, showing MRD negativity means better survival. After all, it means cure. It means cure, so it's got to mean a better overall survival, but it doesn't show that. The truth is there are people who are MRD positive, who have very indolent or slow-growing disease, who live a long time. There are people with MRD negativity who have slow-growing or indolent disease, who live a long time, and there are people with MRD negativity who die of their disease. MRD negativity is slightly better than not being MRD negative, but it's not destiny. It's not cure. It's not synonymous with cure. That's a misnomer. And we have never seen any reasonable basis to believe that myeloma can be cured. When the CAR-T products were first debuted, people thought they would cure people. They have a 100% relapse rate. They don't cure a single person. They cure people with pediatric ALL. They cure people with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. They don't cure a single person with multiple myeloma. That's been an overwhelming disappointment. Allogeneic stem cell transplant doesn't work in myeloma. It's a fool's errand. It doesn't cure people. It cures people with AML. Okay, it cures people with CML back in the diggity. Auto transplant with Hodgkin's cures people with Hodgkin's. It doesn't cure people with myeloma. We've seen no evidence that those last plasma cells can be eradicated. There's no reason to think that MRD negativity as an accelerated approval endpoint will increase cure rates. That's just rhetoric. That's not fact. And again, this is being pushed by the advocacy organizations. One of the advocacy organizations I looked up, HealthTree, if you look at their list of sponsors, and maybe I'll put that up on the screen. Put that up on the screen, minute 18. Put that up, I have to keep track of where to put it up on the screen. Put it up on the screen. It's a who's who of pharmaceutical firms. They're funded by all these pharmaceutical firms, and their talking points are encouraging pharmaceutical profits, and they have missed sight of what's actually best for patients. Someone I know was telling me about how they were invited to give a talk at a patient advocacy group, and they were going to talk about the topic of how to better critically appraise articles, and when they heard that that was the topic, they canceled the lecture. Okay, so I think we have to be very careful that these advocacy groups are in a very tough position. If they want to keep getting often what can be millions of dollars in annual support from companies, they have to be very careful the stances they take. The company's not going to continue to fund somebody who goes against their vested interests, and I think that's a core problem here. I think the MRD negativity in myeloma is a really interesting case study of how you can get complete regulatory capture in a space and there'll be no dissenting opinions. In my speech in front of the US FDA, I noted that I think I'm the only person who spoke critically of that. I'm the only person, I think, who is I'm one of the few people who may not have been funded by the drug companies. The majority of the speakers who are outside of the FDA have received pharmaceutical payments in the past. The advocacy groups often are funded by the companies. The FDA themselves, while they work at FDA, they can't be funded by the companies, but they often leave the FDA to work for the companies a few years later. So they also have a perverse financial interest. And I think that's the crux of the issue. It's a captured thing. You have lots of people in the community who are not going to be interested in this topic, who are just paying their taxes, and they can't care about myeloma. I mean, it's one of a million diseases out there. They can't focus too much on myeloma. You have a small group of people with a strong incentive to try to change the rules around myeloma that will lead to greater profits. And then you get this sort of really broken system where a conflicted minority can always dominate a largely disinterested majority. All right. So to me, I think people out there watching this video should do some soul searching. If you're a patient, if you care about patients, you want to do what's right for patients, create a patient group that doesn't take pharmaceutical money. Try to hear from people who do well with the cancer, but hear from people who don't do well. Have more videotaped diaries. Let's get the testimony of people who, what's it like to actually have drug-induced Parkinsonism after CAR-T? If you heard that testimony at the meeting, that might have tempered enthusiasm for MRD. If you heard what it was like, it's devastating. This is a very dangerous regulatory precedent. The FDA is going to be moving more and more drugs sooner. Again, it's not about access. These drugs are already available. It's about compelling insurers and other third parties to pay. It's about financially moving money. That's the real goal. The advocates have been unwittingly, I think, co-opted by the companies. The experts, I think, turn a blind eye. I mean, what's the root of the expert rot? I don't think it's corruption. I just think it's that we live in a world where you're going to get more praise, you're going to have more friends, you're going to get more lectures, you're going to have more opportunities. The more you play ball with the pharmaceutical industry, the more you go along with this. And it's easy to fool yourself into thinking you're doing the right thing. You can tell yourself things like we're more likely to have a cure. You can tell yourself things about MRD negativity. It's going to speed access to these products. You can tell yourself things like, well, the FDA, they're not going to let unsafe products on the market. The truth is, they have let unsafe products on the market, and they will do more so of that. They've done a lot of that. They are a very, I would say, troubled agency. Once upon a time, they knew their mission, but I think they've forgotten that in recent years. They've been almost entirely co-opted by the industry. And if I were to analyze what is the root of that, I think it's that for a while, there was a tension in politics where there was at least one side not complacent and complicit with the pharmaceutical firms, and one side was more so. Now I think everybody in politics has aligned itself with pharmaceutical firms, in part because that's the only way you can get donations to win campaigns. And the moment that happens is this pressure on the FDA has been removed, and sort of a pressure is on them politically to just approve more products and keep this gravy train flowing. The money will go to the firms, and the firms will have more money to them in terms of lobbying and in terms of campaign contributions. And I think that's the root of the problem. I think we see the FDA rot in every field, from Alzheimer's drugs to COVID-19 pandemic policy implementations to the cancer field. The cancer field has had the rot for the longest, and I think it's very visible to people why that's a rot, where you can have a drug approved that extends survival 10 days or doesn't improve survival at all. That's a rot. But they're doing a very, I think, strategic job to approve drugs in a way that you won't know there's no survival benefit. They're going to say it's going to take too long, and they may not follow the trials that far, so you won't know. And I would say, I don't want to say obfuscating safety signals, that's not true. I would just say not being very diligent or being a little loose about caring about safety is another strategy to move a lot of costly products to the frontline setting. Advocacy groups, if they really care about patients, they would want to hear this information. They wouldn't want to be critical or demonize people who point out the deep limitations to the data set and to the data here. But I think that they are fundamentally captured, and I think that's a big problem. All right. Those are my thoughts. Patient advocacy groups, FDA, some of the thorny issues here in cancer medicine. I hope we can solve them, but I'm increasingly pessimistic that we can't, and that things are going to reach a tipping point. What will that tipping point look like? If I were to guess, the U.S. is spending 20% of GDP on health care. The average person's working wage has absolutely stagnated. The amount we invest in children, in early nutrition, in schools, and by schools I mean children, not the teachers' unions, which swallow the money and misuse it. That's too low. Those are investments that would pay off. The amount we invest in good infrastructure and transportation and these sorts of things is very poor. We're putting all our money into this financial product that gives very costly products to people nearing the end of life, which may or may not help them, may or may not make them live longer. And that cost is not actually cost to make the product or cost to R&D the product. The cost is value to shareholders. It's transferring money from everybody to a few people. Once that's 20% of GDP, it's a problem. What happens when it's 30%, 40% of GDP? What happens when it's 50% of GDP? They say Rome fell when half the days in the Roman capital were holidays. Perhaps the U.S. will someday fall when half of our GDP spending is on healthcare. This is a runaway train. Nobody wants to stop it. People are cheering it on. they have entirely lost sight of, I think, both the facts of the science of MRD, the data. They're only talking to people who agree with them. The meeting is a great example of only talking to people who agree with you. Watch the, you know, the 7 hours of that video and see how many people are critical. I think it's only me. I think I'm the only critical voice. That's what a couple of people texted me to say. You're the only person I heard talk that I thought made any good points. The moment you get trapped in this groupthink bubble funded by the pharmaceutical industry, you are very unlikely to really read and appreciate, I think, other points of view. And you might even be making some catastrophic errors. So those are my thoughts. If you like this video, you know what to do. Send it to a friend or colleague. You know, tell people about this channel. You can always find me on Instagram. You can find me on Twitter. You can send your recommendations to me in the comments here, or you can send it to me on Instagram. What you want me to talk about in the future, I'll talk about some more topics. I think I'm going to do a cardiology randomized control trial on shock soon. I'm going to do some other topics. And I'm interested to hearing about papers that may interest you. Of course, one thing I'll tell you right off the bat, I'm much more interested in papers that are published in really high-impact journals that may have substantive limitations than I am in talking about papers published in low-impact journals that have substantive limitations. I know they have substantive limitations that are published in rags, so okay, I mean, you know, it's not so hard to find those. The fun ones are the ones that other people missed. You know, that's the fun stuff for me. So, you like this video, you need to do, like, subscribe, comment, hit that notification bell, and I'll be back with more videos. So, stay tuned.